Before we start, this episode contains a lot of conversation that might be triggering for some listeners. If that sounds like it might apply to you, check the show notes for more details. Hello and welcome to Happy Place. I'm Fern Cotton, and this is your weekly reminder to gently inhale and exhale and take some time for yourself. Today, I'm meeting someone who's been meditating on how his relationship with anger and love has changed since childhood. It's Ian Wright.
What I wanted more than anything else, Fern, was just to be hugged and loved. So if I could go back, I'd want to hug him and say, listen, it's going to be fine. You know, remember, this is not, it's not your fault. And what happens is that when I got older and I started to, and I became the patriarch, all of a sudden everybody loves me, the family, because I'm doing well, I'm playing football, earning good money, and all of a sudden I can help everybody. It literally turned like a light switch. Everybody just all of a sudden, boom, we will love you now.
Ian is a football pundit, former Crystal Palace, Arsenal and England player, and host of Ian Wright's Everyday People podcast, and a legend. In January 2020, he recorded his Desert Island Discs and emotionally talked about his difficult upbringing, dealing with domestic abuse at home. After receiving message upon message from people who shared similar stories to him, he decided to look into the issue further with a BBC documentary, talking about his own story in more detail and helping others share theirs. This documentary, Ian Wright, Home Truths, airs on the 6th of May on BBC and BBC iPlayer.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, let's do it. Here's the show. Hi, Ian Wright.
Hey, what's happening, Fern Cotton? You okay?
I'm good. How are you doing today? Are you well? Are you feeling happy?
I am, to be honest. In the main, in my spirits, myself and everything that's going on, very happy. As happy as I've been for a very long time.
God, that's wonderful to hear.
And it's quite nice to be able to say it simply because, you know what I mean? When you look, I used to look for reasons why I weren't happy and then I'd harp on that. But like, I haven't really got many reasons to not be happy in a moment.
That's so, a beautiful thing. I love that.
I'm quite fortunate at the minute.
Good. I'm feeling it too. The sky is blue today and, you know, it's
I think
good.
Maybe as well is because there seems to be light at the end of this kind of tunnel. Yeah. I know we're still in a not lockdown-y vibe, but like the world isn't opened up properly, but it just feels like we're on the road to it opening. So it's something to look forward to. I think that's what it comes down to.
It is. I think we're collectively all feeling that, aren't we? We're sort of, it's an energetic thing. You know, it's not just sort of seeing people out and about and enjoying the sunshine. It's we're energetically like feeling a bit of a lift. And that is such a good thing. I mean,
and we needed it.
We so needed it. I mean, it's been the most bizarre, well, over a year now and one of total extremes. Because I think, you know, for most people, there will have been moments where it felt quite calm and peaceful. But at other times, and for some people, you know, excruciating pain and all sorts of awful stuff happening. And we can see that illustrated. And, you know, this is something I think we've all found hard to accept. But we can see it illustrated in how all of the helplines out there have just skyrocketed. And all the charities that either we know about or ones that I'm sure you work for and I do stuff for, you know, they're all through the roof. And for a plethora of reasons, whether it's, you know, depression, anxiety, but also a subject that you've been really delving into recently, which is domestic abuse. So, you know, I guess first of all, I want to say thank you for making this incredibly powerful documentary because it is massively needed at the moment. Massively needed.
It's funny. It came, Fern, from when I'd done my Desert Island Discs. And it's really strange because they've been asking me to do that for years and years. And I met this lovely lady. I can't remember the lady's name, but she was amazing. I met her at the NTA Awards. And she came over and she was just talking to me. She's lovely and she's telling me all about, she knew everything about me. It was really amazing. And we're talking and I literally couldn't say no to her because she was so wonderful. And, you know, she's saying I'd be great and she'd love to hear my story. She was talking to me like, she said, I would like to hear your story. And so when we'd done it and I then put the music, I tried to, because when they asked me initially, people asked me, I'd say, well, what set songs would I have? I got to have cool tunes because people think I'm really cool. Yeah. And all that rubbish. But then by the time I did get to do it, years and years later, I was putting the music to certain things that happened in my life, what sparked memories of that time. And it was very raw. I didn't realize it was going to be as raw as it was when I picked the songs. And then it's only as soon as we got into the environment and the situation, it just felt very unnerving. And when I started talking, I was very emotional right from there. I was actually emotional when she'd done my intro.
I know. I heard you crying on it. It was brilliant.
Literally heard her do my intro. And I've heard, and people have done stuff like that for me before, like the intro and you listen to it. But as she speak, I knew from then, as she's doing the intro, I started to well up and I thought, oh my God, what's happening here? And I just went into it, Fern. I went into it and I didn't hold anything back. And off of the back of it, it was like the outpouring, the waves. It was like a tsunami of people saying, I experienced the same thing. I listened and I thought to myself, we need to do something. We need to kind of address it, the abuse and mental abuse and the fact that there's kids. There's always kids present. 90% of the time, kids are present. And, you know, my own story is I didn't even realize I was a victim when I was younger. And this is why when we done it, it was one of the most shocking things when the lady, Nuri, her name was, wonderful she was, she explained to me, you were a victim. You're a victim to the person that you needed the most, right? Your mum, obviously my stepdad was my stepdad, and I didn't see it as anything other than, you know, no, it's just happening. It was horrible. I'm totally out of control of it, Fern. This is the thing I try to explain to people now. It's not your fault. You're a child. It's not meant to be happening. There's nothing you could do about it. And those are the things that the messages you're trying to explain to people. But I was very unhappy, you know, like 9-year-old, very unhappy.
It's funny, isn't it? Because so much of the time in life when you've experienced trauma or pain and you've been reluctant to admit that it was trauma or pain, you can't heal from it until you acknowledge it. Because you're just going, no, it wasn't a thing. You know, mine to a lesser degree, having a big dip of depression, you know, 10 odd years ago and circumstantially stuff that was going on. For a long time, I was just like, oh, what do I have to complain about? This is ridiculous. Yeah. But until I got to that point where I could go, no, this was traumatic. I need to honour that it was traumatic. Yeah. Then you can start the healing bit. Mm. But it's hard to get over that initial, that was traumatic.
Mm. You know what it was? When I spoke to Nuri when we was doing the documentary, we kind of realized that, so who's angry? And, you know, I remember when I was younger and they used to ask me questions in class about stuff and I never put my hand up because I thought I'd always get the answer wrong. And, you know, she kind of said, so who's angry? And I was sitting there and I said, I don't know. What do you mean, who's angry? Well, is it the young guy, the middle age? Is it the teenager? Is it the footballer? Was he angry? Who's angry? Are you angry now? And when I thought of it, I thought, when I was nine, I'm still angry for the stuff that when I found myself in rooms crying to the deepness of my soul because something that my mum just said or the beating I might have just got off of him or my mum hit me or just whatever was making me unhappy that day. And there was a daily basis where I'd get something that made me very unhappy, a remark or something. A lot of alcohol and weed smoking involved in my household. And I remember that night was so angry. And when she asked me who's angry, I said, well, probably 9-year-old still angry inside me. And I had that. But what I'd done in the end, because the anger, because I was so suppressed in my house, you know, my stepdad, my mum, my elder brother, not Morris. Morris, my older brother to me, who was amazing. And then my sister, who was the daughter of my stepdad. I was suppressed by all of them all the time. I didn't have nowhere to go in respect of being like continually just on. They were on me all the time. And so when I went outside, I was very angry. Anything would start a fight. Anything would start a confrontation. And I had that as I was growing up. And I think it manifested more when I started to play football and things started to go wrong on the pitch. And I found that when I was younger, to be honest, the one thing I loved doing more than anything else was playing football. When it went wrong on the pitch, I lashed out because I felt like someone was taking away my real one love, and it's mine. And if you're better than me, I don't know. It had a damning effect on me. And I think I took that into my professional game. And this is where it really manifested. I've done some of my worst stuff, punching people, fighting, doing stuff, swearing. All the sort of stuff is where I found that I needed help.
Yeah, because, you know, of course, like we've all tried to suppress certain emotions, and we've all wanted to not look at certain things in our life, but they just have to come out, don't they? They have to manifest. Yeah. They cannot be contained. Yeah. Do you think, you know, in those times, I know you've talked about this in the documentary, where, you know, you might have lashed out when you were playing a game or when you were back in the changing room afterward. Did you make that connection then that was that suppressed emotion?
No, it's only when I started seeing this wonderful lady, Rosalind Craig. And the things what I always try to say to people about getting help is that, yes, I was fortunate enough to afford to get help. It's not cheap. Mm. It's not cheap. And the thing is that I know that people need help. I needed help. And it's only when I started to speak to her, Fern, everything stemmed back to my childhood and my mum and the stepdad and the anger. Everything stemmed back to it. And then it's then trying to unravel it, unravel the anger, things she said. And I remember I remember when I first went in there, Fern, I was just telling lies because, like, and then I remember she said after about three sessions, she said, listen, you're paying quite a lot of money for this and you're not being truthful. You're not telling me the truth. If you want me to help you, then you're going to have to tell me the truth. And I've never told anybody, whether it's the stigma of feeling like it's weakness, I don't know what it was, but I never spoke to anybody like I spoke to her after that. In respect of letting it out. And I literally, as soon as I started talking, started saying some stuff about my mum and stuff, I couldn't stop the bawling. And from there on, it's been a gradual healing process up to the point now where I can speak about it, you know, in certain scenarios and not well up and not cry. Because the problem I have is going back to a 9-year-old that literally everybody when I was younger didn't like. For no reason of my own. And it was very difficult. So there's a lot of rejection issues I had as well, especially when I tried to play football when I was younger. The rejection and, you know what I mean, feeling sorry for myself all the way through that time to get to football. It was a real hard road. And I just had all that pent up inside. And, you know, it was really difficult until I started to speak to her.
Yeah, it like you say, you know, so many people out there for so many reasons need to revisit, well, don't need to, but it would be helpful to revisit stuff from childhood, things that have held them back or whatever. But a lot of the time it does, unfortunately, come down to money, accessibility, etc.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I think, you know, from, you know, I've sort of done quite a lot of therapy over the years. And one of the things I've found is, often you have to kind of go back and you have to parent your own inner child. So you learn to parent yourself as a young kid, because I will still react sometimes from that place of the inner child. I'll be super defensive or I'll get really angry about something, and I know it's not coming from an adult place. How do you deal with that dynamic? If you can see yourself reacting from that place now, do you just let it happen? Do you try and stop it?
No. It's not that I've got any mechanism to stop it, but what it is that it's like the question when people say, what would you say to your 9-year-old self now? And it's like, I probably wouldn't say anything of real note that's going to make him just like go, oh, is that it? No. What I wanted more than anything else, Fern, was just to be hugged and loved. And it was, and everything was going to be fine because, like I said, I couldn't understand the words, some of the things that my mum would say, how nasty she was on a daily basis, my stepfather being scared to even go into the same room, all that sort of stuff. So if I could go back, I'd want to hug him and say, listen, it's going to be fine. You know, remember, this is not, it's not your fault. And what happens is that when I got older and I started to, and I became the patriarch, all of a sudden everybody loves me in the family because I'm doing well, I'm playing football, I'm earning good money, and all of a sudden I can help everybody. It literally turned like a light switch. Everybody just all of a sudden, boom, we will love you now. And it was really hard, very confusing. And I, you know what? I was even more angry. Because what was happening was in that scenario, Fern, is that when people were talking to me, and I said, I remember when you were saying these things to me. I remember when I couldn't even stay in the same room as you. Now you're all over me because you once, it was the feeling of being used. All of a sudden, again, it took me to another place of proper anger, to the point where, you know, you kind of, for me then, I went through a few years of not caring really about stuff. I was really on that. Apart from, as long as I was scoring and doing well, I really went on a blast.
Yeah, well, of course, like growing up in a house where love was lacking, that's going to have impacted you so massively, you know, developmentally and just with your growth. And, well, you know, what's your dynamic with love like today? Can you receive love easily, or do you still have a bit of a block with that?
No, it's taken a while to be able to, because like my wife now, our whole family's all, everything's just love, and, you know, they're just lovely people. They kind of got a hippie kind of vibe about them, you know. My mother-in-law is the greatest woman in the world. You know what I mean? When she's young, she's like 18. She got this little place in Greece and she's built it up to this unbelievable thing because she's so creative. She works at a theatre. Everybody's so creative and loving and brilliant in there. And I remember, like, Nancy would not let me not. How can I explain it? When I would get into my moments of like getting into myself because of the anger and the stuff, she wouldn't let me do it. She'd want me to speak. She'd want to hug me. And it was very difficult at the start because I didn't want it. I was like pushing it away. I didn't know how to deal with it. And I suppose especially with football, the love was different because it was a love from the terraces and people just pouring love on you for what you were able to do. And I felt like I was just wallowed in that. But the tactile, close, trying to give you the love that you need, the huggy, touchy stuff, I've found very difficult. Very difficult.
Is there an element of like feeling like you didn't deserve it?
It's not a case of not deserving it, but I think it was I didn't trust it because it was something, right? I didn't know and recognize too much. I remember saying when I started going out with my missus, I used to say things like, "Oh God, I just wasn't hugged," and like, you know, when people mess around and say it, when we do it, and I say, "I just wasn't hugged as a child," and the fact is that I wasn't really hugged. So I feel quite sad about that because I said, you know, I genuinely wasn't. And then I started to tell her about the stories and that. And then obviously she just wanted to make sure that I felt love all the time. I feel love all the time now. It's taken me a while to be able to deal with the tactile love and people just loving you just because, just for you. Because remember when I started getting love, adulation kind of love, it wasn't real because it was because the goals are scored or you're playing for the team and you're something that people look up to because you're their hero in respect to the goals you're scoring for their team. So then what happens is once you stop doing that kind of love, it can go away. Of course, people still give you the respect and the love now, but the fact is, it's not the love that I was craving when I was a child from the people that I loved, you know? So it was very difficult to deal with genuine love, what I get now on a daily basis.
Yeah, love with no strings attached.
No strings,
at all.
Yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Because you went from, like, that's two big extremes. You know, you went from no, you know, family love and that sort of close, intimate love at home to then mass adulation. Millions of people adoring you. And we all know, well, you'll know better than anyone, how football fans and pundits will just turn on you. You know, yes. If things aren't going well, that goes. You know, how did that mess with your head?
Again, you kind of go into a place where when it starts going against you, where people all of a sudden like you do something wrong and then people are criticizing and being nasty, which I had a lot of, then you go into, you go back to that place of, like I said, I'd come out of the house when I was younger and anything happened, bam, you have a fight. Now, obviously I can't have a fight when I'm older than a footballer, but like what I'd go into is that person of protecting myself by any means, you know what I mean? And that means saying things maybe to people who do so. Like, for instance, it would all come out, like I say, on the football pitch with the fans, with this and that. It would get me into even more trouble just trying to protect myself from people just having a go at me, because it happened to me when I was younger and I had no way of protecting myself. You know, no, of feeling helpless. You know, that was the worst thing. You know, the worst thing I think about when I was growing up is the helplessness, and especially when he was like bullying my mum and hitting my mum and holding her up against the wall and stuff like that. I found the helplessness, what I had there, was something that I'd never forget. And it's just a situation I'd never want to be in again. And it's funny because, like, any kind of bullying at school or anything like that, I literally could not stop myself from being in and around and stopping that kind of scenario. Because when you're younger and you... I tell you the worst thing, Fern, is when you're not in the room and you know something's going on in the room and my mum's what, 4'11". I tell people that he was like 6'2", and you can hear her and you can hear the noises and you can't go in the room and you're just petrified. You know, that kind of scenario was the kind of thing that when I was angry, those are the things that would come back into my head. And then you're looking at someone who's getting ready to lash out. And I think a lot of it came when I played football, whether I was training or whether I was playing in the game, whether I blasted off with fans, whether I, you know, anything, you know, because I didn't know how to deal with it.
I mean, God, you just had so much to deal with, because obviously for so long you didn't have an outlet, you didn't have a way of processing all of this anger and pain and trauma that you'd been through. And obviously for a lot of hard work and introspection and digging around in your past, you've been able to get to a place... Does it feel peaceful, a peaceful place of it now, or a place of acceptance?
Yeah, it's a lot more peaceful now, because what I've done, Fern, is it's very difficult to try and get... The lady, Rosalind, she's always said, you need to speak to your mum, you need to talk to her. So, but talking about a generation of people that I don't know what my mum went through herself.
Yeah.
It was very tough for her, because for her to treat and say the things she said to me when I was a child, she must have had some serious stuff happen to her, which she never, ever... spoke about. So it wasn't a case of trying to speak to my mum for any form of forgiveness. I wanted to try and speak to her so as I could close it off for myself, so then I could move on, because the main thing is to break the cycle of it.
Yeah,
that's what it came down to, you know. And as many times I tried to have the conversation, you know what I mean, but like I said, my mum didn't want to talk about that kind of stuff. But for me, I had to close it off myself, and this is why I had to seek help. And the help that I got helped me to be able to deal with it and deal with the 9-year-old. And it's funny, because Nuri said to me, well, you're 57 now, you could deal with a 9-year-old. If those kind of little feelings come up, they come up now if I'm playing golf, when I'm playing shit golf or something, Fern. I could deal with it now, because I don't have any reasons to get as angry as I was. But
yeah,
it's really helped me to realize, well, who's angry? Why are you being that angry? Why have you gone to that place? Because it was so easy when I was younger to go straight from 0 to 0 in respect of anger, because of the environment I was in. And so I'd always, like now, I could just say, just chill, man, just relax. You know, it's taken me quite a long time to get to that.
But it's not easy. It's not easy, is it? It's one of the hardest things to do. Like, you know, I think when anyone says it out loud, it sounds easy. Like, oh, and then I decided to not be angry. But we can feel so held back by our past. Mm. And for a lot of people, they might go through their whole lives without making that change, without breaking the chain, without going, you know what, this anger is not serving me anymore. I cannot keep reacting from this place. I cannot be a victim of my childhood as a grown adult. You know, but so many people don't want to do the work, or don't look at the work, or just feel completely debilitated by it. You know, it's probably one of the hardest things you can do in life, is to make a change.
Is to make a change. Recognise that you need to make a change.
Yeah.
Because I went through a number of years, because everything was so comfortable around me. No one in and around me is letting me really know that, you know, you need help. You know, sometimes you snap, you know what I mean? You say things to people, which was just nasty. Some of the times I didn't have people around me because who were helping me, people around me that I slowly weeded out over the years. And that is a vital thing you need to do.
Yes.
And some, you know, it's easy to spot them because they do things that you think, well, that's not nice. You know, I've known you for a long time. That's not the kind of thing friends do. That's not the kind of thing friends say. It's not the kind of, you don't use people like you're using. And so you slowly, as the years go by, you eliminate the people around you, and you start to put the right people around you in. And you're not talking about sycophant people. You're talking about people who would say, no, man, listen, that's wrong. You know what I mean? You can't say that. You can't be like that. You can't act like that. You can't. You just need that. You know what I mean? And like I say, when I went to speak to Roslyn, I just learned so much about myself to try and say, be honest with you. You have to be able to look yourself in the mirror, friend. There's a many, many years I couldn't because I didn't like what I saw for a start. And I didn't feel, even with everything that was going well for me with the football, I didn't feel fulfilled. I'm playing football and it's like the job of my dreams. It's my dream to do what I'm doing. Sometimes I come from a football match and just feel sad, just feel a bit like empty. And it was that's when you start to, well, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? And I didn't know. So then I remember, I think it came, one of the main ones, friend, is that I got sent off in a game. And as I got sent off, I just turned and I was so angry, thinking that I'd been so wronged by the referee, that I kicked the door in and I just smashed the room to bits. It was like a blackout rage that I had because I felt wronged. And I didn't even realize till I came out of the room what happened. And that was one of the things where I was like, I can't keep doing that.
You know, you talked about that sadness in the documentary when, you know, there's a really poignant moment where you're with your family and your wife and you're having dinner and you sort of admit that, you know, you've got a happy family, you've got a happy family now, but there is that sadness can still sometimes creep in. Do you think that is because it's familiar? It's sort of almost a comfort zone to have that sadness nearby?
You know what it is, Fern? I think that to have the happiness, and like I see, and this is why I say Nancy helps me so much and my girls and their family and the people I've got around me now, is because when it's that good, I genuinely think something's going to make it unhappy and sad.
I know that.
So
feeling.
I think that what happens is, Fern, is that you try to initiate to make it start going like bad. Like my missus recognized it very early. She said, I know what you're doing. Don't do it. Just don't do it. You know, everything is brilliant. We're in this really lovely place. And like, you know, why are you retreating? Why are you making it a place like you're going to be unhappy? Don't go to that place. And literally you just need somebody to say that, because then you recognize it. Then you have to put your ego aside and say, yeah, because it's very easy for me to do that with Nance now and say, okay, yeah, you're right. you know, but the thing is, Fern, I needed that.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is that when things are going right for me, I feel like I've got to make something go wrong, because it's going to go wrong anyway, because that's how it's always been for me.
Yeah, and like, you're protecting yourself.
That's all it was. You know, that's all it was from nine all the way through the teenage, adolescent years, all those times. When things are going so right, something inside me wanted to make it like, well, it's going to happen anyway, so I might as well initiate it. And it's taken me, like, again, years, and somebody like my wife to realise that I know what's going on here and I'm not going to make that happen.
It's sort of either hearing it or saying it out loud, isn't it? Because that resonates with me massively. You know, I think after I had that big spell of depression, I certainly went through probably a decade of doing just that, which would usually come from a place of self-loathing. So something was going well and I was waiting for this bad news or this bad situation. So I would sink into self-loathing, start berating myself, being really horrible to myself internally to protect myself from something that probably wasn't going to happen anyway. I mean, it's perverse that I think so many of us do that.
You know what I used to do? When she used to say that to me, especially the first times, and I would realise it, and it was literally a fight with myself. I'd have to go upstairs. I'd go upstairs in the room. I'd say, I'm just going to go and do something. I'd literally have to go upstairs in the room and have a fight with myself, saying, please stop it. I don't want to be that person. Literally on my own, speaking to myself in the room, trying to flush that out, flush that horrible negativity out. And I'd literally fight it, like, please, I don't want to do this. I want everybody to be happy around me. And so that was something that I used to do quite a lot. Don't let the ego of not say, Nance, you are absolutely right. I could do that now instantly. I could do it instantly now.
It's having a decent relationship with yourself, isn't it? It's having
looking in the mirror, yeah?
Looking in the mirror, yeah. And how, you know, are you at a place now where you have that self-acceptance, you have self-compassion, which I think is probably one of the foundations, the fundamental things in everyday happiness is that self-compassion.
Yes, I do, because like I have no problem in saying to myself, well, nice one. You do it. Yes, you're all right, man. You're doing good today. It's nice. You know what I mean? Because I think that what happens is that You know, you can't say that out loud to people too much to say, you know, I'm having a great day. I can say that now. I'm having a great day. I feel really good. I look in the mirror, I like what I see. I'm moving right. I'm doing stuff. I feel good about myself. And what I do like is being able to say that because it makes me feel good when I'm now going out to the world. I do have self-compassion. I can say, don't feel sorry for yourself. You know, yes, you know, yeah, it's quite a sad thing, but you know something. Talk to myself like that. Like how when I'm in the car and I speak to a higher force, whether it's there or not, if you believe that sort of stuff. That's like my biggest arguments with the higher force, whatever it is now. But I do a lot of talking to myself just to make myself feel better. No, I don't want to think that. You know, sometimes you're in the car, you drive along, and you know, I just think, no, that's, you're not coming in that negative. No, you're not coming in. I put something on, put a record on, a blast a really cool tune. And then, yes, I'm back again. Put on a positive song. And so that's the way I do it. That's the way I try and do it now. But I'd implore people to feel good about yourself with that self-compassion because it makes you feel good.
Yeah. Well, one of my mates once said, if you've got like a bad thought or it could be a person that's trying to infiltrate the good space you're in, you're like, you're the bus driver and you just kick him off the bus. Just go, get off. Don't want you in my bus. Yeah. Get out of my bus. You know, one of the things that I really admire with what you've done with, you know, making this documentary, but also the personal work you've done to really dive into a very painful place of the past is because it's so often the case, and I've had this in my own life, where you don't want to look there because it feels... It obviously, it's too painful, it's too dark, you just want to push it to one side. But actually, and I wonder if you found the same, when you start to look into those dark corners and you do start to dig around, it's never as bad as you'd imagined. It's never as painful as you'd... It's like you've locked away some big monster, which is actually gruesome and huge and awful over here. But actually, when you go and meet with that feeling all that time and you sit with it, it's hard, but it's not as bad.
No, and it's taken a long time to get to that simply because, like I said, I just think of the fact that people were just being nasty because they could. It's very difficult to explain because I'm not that person. I'm not that nasty person. I don't want to make somebody unhappy. I could not just sit there like how my mum would be. I'd walk into a room and she'd tell me to get out or something because she can't stand me or, you know what I mean? Anything like that. And, you know, I look back at that and I think, well, she was... Again, I'm able to now say, I don't know what she went through for her to be that nasty to me. So like you say, when you go back and you think about it, it does seem like it's not that bad, but it's only because of who it's coming from. You know, it's who it's coming from for me, what hurt deep down, because I would see love being given to other siblings. I'd see that kind of stuff. That was the thing that hurt more than anything else, because then when you see that, some of the times, some of the days, she didn't say anything to me of any real note of nastiness, but then she'd be all over my brother Morris or she'd be all over my sister. And then that would make me go into the room and feel really like, well, why does that happen to me? You know what I mean? So you look back and you think to yourself, as a child, that was my world. She's my world, my mum.
Yeah.
And everything like that. And so you look back at it and you say, yeah, she could have been nicer, but it's a lot easier for me to deal with simply because I think I've forgiven myself and I've forgiven her. I've forgiven her.
Yeah, forgiveness is the biggest release, isn't it? I don't want what I said previously to sound reductive of you having to do that hard work in any sense. I think what I meant was when any of us go back and look at a painful time, the relief that we'll get from dealing with it will be so much better and more powerful than just ignoring it forever.
Yes, 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 without a doubt.
There is relief. There will always be a relief, even if it is awful to look at and hard work.
You know, the thing is, Fern, I think one of the toughest moments in that documentary was when I went back to the house for the first time since we left there, because that was the house and that room.
Don't know how you where did we that. Had.
Yeah. I thought I was ready for that. You know what I mean? I'm not going to give anything away, but it was the room where I remember the darkest moments. I think it was my youngest time trying to watch Match of the Day and having to face the wall and the cold wall, feeling claustrophobic, very asthmatic at the time, my brother covering my ears. And then when I went into that room and saw, honestly, it literally flooded back. It's like you watch a film and you literally go back in time to the moment. And it was really, really intense. But I think that I had to do it, and I'm glad I did it. I'll never go back there again, if I'm really totally honest, but I'm glad I did it simply because it made me feel like you can deal with that now, even though when I touched the wall, it was still cold and it was still just like, it was still a horrible kind of like experience. But I would rather, Fern, have gone back and done that than know that I'm going along my way, knowing what kind of memories and emotions that would evoke. So I'm quite pleased I've done that, because now I feel like I've dealt with that, as tough as that was.
Yeah, it allows you to release it, like let go of it, you know.
You've got to try.
When I was watching that bit of the documentary, I mean, it was unbelievably moving, and, you know, I can't imagine how that felt to go back into that space. And it got me thinking, you know, you went from being this kid who had to face the wall when Match of the Day was on. Your stepfather, just out of pure cruelness, made you face the wall so you couldn't see, you know, your escapism, your passion and your joy on the TV behind you, probably your one bit of joy that day.
Yeah.
Do you think any of that impacted how much you really pushed yourself when you were getting into professional football playing? Mm. Was that an impetus for you to go, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you that I'm not only worthy of watching that show, I'm worthy of being on that show.
It would have been a million miles from my thoughts, if I'm going to be totally honest, because like I say, Fern, through the years when I was trying to become a footballer, trying to get into youth academies and that, the rejection, it just compounded everything else. Just not good enough, worthless, nothing. You're worthless, you're not good enough. And you know what I mean? I remember my mum used to say things when I used to go to the trials that many are called and few are chosen. You know what I mean? And it was something that she used to say all the time when I'd come back and I hadn't made it. So I don't know deep down where the drive came from, but the one thing that I did learn when I started talking about when I did finally become a professional footballer at 22, trying from the age of 10, is that for some reason, the first person I called was my mum. And obviously we were both ecstatic, but I don't know if I called her because I wanted to prove to her that, yes, I could do it, or I was genuinely, she was the first person I wanted to share my happiness with. And that was a confusing thing for me, because I think the more I do think about it, it was to say, I did it. So I was one of the chosen ones without any kind of support from any of you lot. For some reason, it's happened. It's taken me 12 years to get here, but it's happened. But I don't know where the drive came from, but I tell you, the drive from there on came because I knew that now I've got a chance, because it was the first time in my life and I had clarity in where I was going. And it was all up to me now. If I train hard, work hard, live right, then I'm probably going to be a success, judging by what the manager thinks of me and what they think of me. They've invested in my ability now. So it was the first time in my life that I was able to move forward with some clarity of where I'm going, because the years previous, there was nothing, and there was nothing to build anything on. So the drive came from, I personally believe, my love of football. Just wanted to play. And I ended up playing a very high level of Sunday morning football with my friends who I loved. I kind of got over the fact that it wasn't going to happen for me with football, simply because I was getting a bit too old. But now I get so many people writing to me and they say things even before they tried to. Ian Wright didn't make it till he was 22, so I can still do it, which I'm really proud of. But like, if I'm really totally honest, you know, it happened in such a short space of time before I knew it. I was a very poor labourer and plasterer. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm a professional footballer with a direction in life.
Mm. But it's remarkable that there wasn't a time when you just gave up and, you know, let your childhood and that sort of lack of encouragement get to you. You know, you didn't. You just kept on going with it.
Fern, it was very difficult to get. I don't know. This is what I would love to be able to say to people. No, what I'd done was this because of that.
Yeah.
I just believed it felt normal that people were just being very negative. You know, it felt very normal. But the one thing that people couldn't be negative with me about was how good I was. But then the negativity would come, because then you don't make it into the trials. And then all of a sudden people are saying, well, see, you are no good. So then you start somewhere, like, it beats you down a bit. And you have to find the self-belief. You have to find it in yourself. You have to find it.
I mean, there's obviously one person that really helped cultivate that self-belief, and that was your teacher, Mr. Pigman, who I know I've heard
Mr.
you talk
Pigden,
about.
Yeah.
Pigden, sorry. Yeah. I've heard you talk about him so beautifully. Yeah. And obviously there's that much watch video of you online meeting up with him later down the line in life, which I think, again, had such a huge impact on so many people. Just before I started recording now, I was chatting to Russell Brand on the phone, and I said, oh, I'm about to chat to Ian Wright. And he said, oh my God, you have to tell him, well, not only how much he loves you, but also when he watched that video and listened to your Desert Island discs, he broke down in tears. And he's sort of dedicated this whole section of his new book to you and that video and the impact that it had on him, because it was so massive. And I think it is just always beautiful when we see sort of, I guess, like an angel sent down, isn't it?
Exactly. You couldn't have said it any better, Fern, to be honest.
It's a beautiful thing.
But you know what, Fern? You say that an angel, and it's only as I've got older and realised how he literally, just off of his own gumption, whatever you want to say, just said, no, I'm gonna look after this guy. I don't know what it was, Fern. I was outside the classroom three times that week, and he saw me three times. And the third time, he just went into the class, had a word with the teacher, Mrs. Dance. And when he came out, he just said to me, come with me. And, you know, from then on, he taught me to read and write properly. You know what I mean? I was struggling with that sort of stuff, because as soon as I didn't grasp the lesson, Fern, I would start to be disruptive. And so he taught me that. He gave me some responsibility. You know what, Fern? I knew he loved me for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know why he chose me. You know, he could have had an unbelievable career in the army, in the military, and he chose to be a teacher because he wants to change someone's life. I like to think it was I was the life that he changed for me to go on to do what I'd done. And then when he met me in that video and he says, Ian, I'm so proud of what I think of it now, he's basically I'm gonna go again.
Simply me because too.
when he used to say to me, just you know, if you don't know Ian, you must ask. And I still do that to this day. Taught me about goal scoring, about, you know, I remember he used to roll his sleeves up. He used to have his tie, roll his sleeves up. He had these really shiny shoes, and he'd just play football with us. And he'd always say to me, don't blast it, Jimmy Greavesy, and pass it into the goal. He always gave me those little nuggets. But when I saw him at Arsenal, and the thing about it is, Fern, because I was so young and I used to always come around to his waist, so he was about three steps higher than me when we met. So I was around his waist again. So I felt like I was seven again.
That's so lovely,
I
though.
Know. And so he was the first male who came into my life that I genuinely loved and trusted and felt that he felt the same about me. I think about him every day simply because the mere fact that I'm here, being able to do what I'm doing, and everything's gone well. Like I say, he said to me, I'm so pleased with how it's going for you, Ian. You've done really well. Bam, it finishes me every single time. Simply because he saw me outside that classroom, and he felt like, right, let me help him. Now, you go back to that school and they've got people like Mr. Pigden in place to recognize that youngster and the problems that that youngster might be having at home, so as then they can come and speak about it. Because that's what I'd love to say to anybody, to tell somebody, to let people know, you know, that's the main thing with this, is let people know that you're unhappy, whatever it is, however you're able to speak to them. But like I say, they've got people now, especially my old school Turnham, that can recognise that kind of behaviour. But I was very fortunate that he recognised it. And on that particular day, in that particular week, he saw me outside a classroom on too many occasions, Fern, and he changed my life. And he changed my life.
But it was lovely in the documentary when you went back to your old school. And as you say, was the teacher's name Alexander? Was it Alexander?
Yes, Mr. Alexander.
Mr. Alexander. And he's just, like you say, doing brilliant things. So rather than going, this kid's being naughty, I'm going to punish them, he's going, right, this behaviour is obviously unusual. Let's talk to the kid. Let's address it. And what a shift that is. And you know, maybe that's happened too late down the line. We should have had this all happening years ago. But, you know, it's slowly coming in. But I wonder, like, is enough being done in schools to help kids that are having trouble at home, which, of course, is going to not only impact them at school, but, you know, later down the line in life, is enough being done?
I don't think enough can be done. I think it's the kind of appointment in schools that's needed, simply because, especially the back of this lockdown as well.
Yeah.
What's going on in the households. Because I look at the lockdown, Fern, and I could look at it in a way and think to myself, now, if I was back when I was seven, eight, nine, and that kind of age. And I was locked in with him, my mum, and everything like that. I don't know how that would have panned out. You know what I mean? And people have gone through that in the last year. It's risen in respect of abuse, and it's gone through the roof. And like I say, there's kids present. So you're hoping that it's something that be rolled out in schools, simply because you have to recognize that. It has to be recognized, because it can only go on to cause more problems and cause more hurt, and the cycle then doesn't get broken. You know, I was very, very fortunate. Turnham are very lucky to have someone like Mr. Alexander doing what he's doing there. And that's the kind of thing that is needed, because it's very difficult for you to go and just speak to someone and say, listen, this has happened.
It is.
You know, this has happened at home and that's happened at home. You do need that expertise in the school to recognize that these things are happening.
Well, that's right. The teacher needs to, or the helper, whoever it is, needs to coax it out of the kids. Because, you know, also being a kid, you don't know if that's the right thing to do, to speak up, to say something. Are you going to get your parents in trouble? You know, that's a really scary place to be for a kid. And especially on the first lockdown, I felt sick about it, knowing that was all going on as we were forced to shut schools. And, you know, I've got young kids, and I was thinking, I can't imagine. I didn't have the capacity to believe that was going on everywhere. And then watching your documentary, hearing the statistics that 1.6 million women in the last 12 months will have been subjected to domestic violence. And as you said, was it 90% of the time kids are present around? It's shocking. It's like chilling.
And I think they've just now tried to pass a law where they're saying that, yes, kids are affected. Because before they said that the kids, they're not really dealing with the kids. It's not affecting the kids. But there's a law now that they're going to pass that the kids have to be affected by that. It must be. We know they are.
I know they are.
Because I was affected by it. So you're hoping those are the kind of things that they could see through, they could lobby and get those through Parliament. Because I think that it's vitally important that cycles are broken. Otherwise, it's just going to get worse. I think we're going to find out the real ramifications of this last lockdown and abuse in the household in not too distant future. And I think it's going to be shocking, even more shocking.
I do. And it makes me feel really, really sad.
That does make you feel sad. Yeah.
Well, you're right, because, you know, people are just coming out the other end of experiencing that lack of escape, or lack of, you know, being with a great teacher like Mr. Alexander or Mr. Pigden. You know, that lack is huge and so detrimental. And like you say, we're going to see the fallout. Now we're slowly going back to normal. And this is almost the crunch time now. This is the time where schools and certainly governments need to step up and go, right, what are we going to do? Like, we've been through that awful time. What are we going to do for these kids now? How are we going to help them? You know, this is the crunch time, because it's just, God, it just doesn't bear thinking about. And again, that's why it's just so important that you've made the documentary and that you were willing to do that hard work on camera, because I can't imagine how that felt, not only having to dig around in your past, but to do it, you know, in front of other humans. That's a place of vulnerability.
And like I say, it was a journey, because I didn't know how I was going to react to certain things. And I tried to, as much as I could, Fern, I was just myself in it. I wasn't trying to be let me find out. I was literally myself asking questions. Sometimes, you know what I mean? I can't help laughing at certain situations simply because of the way my personality is. And you know what I mean? I'm not going to go in there and act like anything that I'm not. I'm exactly who I am. And when I said I would do this, I didn't realize how much of an emotional toll it would take on me. It really was tough. You know, sometimes it's very hard. Some of the sleepless nights kind of vibe. Knowing, for instance, that like the night before I went back to the house, literally couldn't sleep. That was tough. But like knowing that it had to be done, and the response already from people who has seen little bits of it. I won't watch it the same time as everybody else, because I just get too nervous. But like the response of people has been fantastic up to this point. And the main thing for me is that the perpetrators, like the abuser and the abused, both of those sets of people can find help. I think that's the biggest message out there. You know, I want people to look at it and recognize and see, like, I'm going to get in touch with these people. You know, like some unbelievable charities like the Hampton Trust, you know, Safecore, unbelievable charities that can help people in these times. You know what I mean? Search them out. because the cycle has to be broken for, and that's the main thing for me.
Yeah,
you know, you have to delve into it, and as hard as it is, I cannot stress how rewarding it will be at the end of it for everybody.
Well, thank you for highlighting these great organizations on the documentary, because you know you're instantly putting them out to millions of people that could really, really need to see it. So it's beautiful work, and as I said, you know, I'm full of admiration that you sort of have delved back into the past in such a way, and also were happy to be filmed doing it, because it's a powerful, yes, powerful bit of TV. It really is. It's an amazing, amazing documentary. And thank you so much for talking today. It's been a total honour, Ian Wright. God, how wonderful to have you on. I feel very, very lucky.
It's been an honour for me to speak to you, Furkan. It's not an honour. You know what I mean? I'm just pleased to be able to speak to you. It's very nice. It's very easy to speak to you.
Oh, I'm glad. I've had literally every male in my family say, oh my God, please tell him hi. I'm like, he doesn't know you. Why am I going to say, like, hello from my brother-in-law, Tyrone? He doesn't know
nice
you.
Nice one, Tyrone. Nice one, Tyrone. I'm sending love, Tyrone. You know, it's like my, like Russell Brand. You know, I've spent a couple of some times with him. I know he's a mad West Ham.
He said,
fan,
yeah.
He's somebody that I love listening to and speak to. So I'm pleased that he said that. But yeah,
I can't thank you enough. You made a huge impact on him, and it's in his new book that he's got coming out soon. And he was like, it just had a profound. And like this documentary, you know, you're doing really incredible work that's having huge ripple effects in such a positive way. It's a beautiful thing. So thank you, Ian Wright.
Thanks, Fern Cotton.
Oh, I cannot even begin to thank you for your time and energy today, Ian. I think Ian might be the nicest person I've ever interviewed. What an amazing, giving man. His documentary, Ian Wright, Home Truths, is a masterpiece. A difficult watch at times, but so incredibly powerful. It airs on the BBC on the 6th of May at 9 p.m. and will also be available on BBC iPlayer for you to watch in your own time. For more details on those wonderful organisations that Ian mentioned, as well as further help should you need it, head to the show notes. Please remember, there are people you can talk to. You can also share your own stories and thoughts with us on Instagram. We love hearing from you at Happy Place Official. We're building a beautiful little community there. And of course, there'll be another impressive person here next Monday to get those cogs in your brain whirring for the week. So hit that subscribe button on your podcast app if you haven't already. Thank you again to Ian, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you for listening. Thank you so much. I'll see you soon.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.